is counted.
Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, let's see, where do we start? The Supreme Court decision on Obamacare. Terrible job numbers from last Friday. Is the economy in a holding pattern? Is the Obama campaign in chaos? Why can't the president get his message out? The Romney camp is under fire for outsourcing and offshore accounts. Is this something that the electorate is concerned about? Speaking of the electorate, our moderator, me, is going to go on a soapbox today about why it's important to do your research on candidates. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Remember us? This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. We actually have a show every Tuesday that isn't a rerun. The same show that we've run two times in the past 2 weeks. But this is live. It's our re-coming back. It's our rebirth, our renaissance, if you will. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District, the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, how you doing?
I have three things to say.
Go ahead.
First of all, your introduction now makes it impossible to ever rerun this program.
Yeah, pretty much.
Secondly, welcome back.
Thank you.
All of us who have stalwartly been here every week slaving away.
Oh, here
we
go. Here we go.
We truly missed you.
Yeah. Are you Jewish? Because that Jewish guilt is just running rampant right now. That's amazing.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't mind being. How does one get to become a Jew?
And we start off with Al. Setting to my 11 o'clock, he is...
Wait a minute.
What's the
third thing I wanted to say? You're going to do a soapbox?
I want to do a soapbox.
Where
today
did you find one big enough?
Oh, wow.
I'm done now.
Are you done? Can I introduce the rest of the panel?
Yes, they're civil.
Yeah, and to my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, well, at least from now on, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is longtime Senate staffer and Washington insider, and a very distinguished and handsome gentleman at the Stimson Center, and new grandfather. He is Alan Moore. Alan, congratulations.
Thank you. My life is full. My new bride is in the audience.
Yeah, that's right. The new Mrs. Moore. The new Mrs. Moore's here in the audience.
And a new friend of the family.
A new friend of the family. Yeah. A new friend of Mrs. Moore.
Yay. And a new grandson. But even with all that fullness, there's been this little absent piece that we're now filling in, and I'm so glad to have you back.
Oh, it's good to be back. It is so good to be back. Sitting at my 12 o'clock, as he does every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the longtime Washington insider and former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation. He's the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, hello.
Well, I'm not going to get carried away like my two previous friends here. I'm just going to say, glad to see you back. Let's get to it.
And to my 2 o'clock, he is the former chairman of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is longtime Washington insider, Carl Tuvin. Carl, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine. I just want you to know that when we found out that your candidate had lost in the election, we sat shiva for 3 nights.
Understanding the fact that this now means that the Democrats are probably going to take that race, so you're probably lighting candles, too.
Yeah.
And to my right, he is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a Bard-certified attorney in the state of New York and the great District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Dr. Winnie, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be back with everybody.
Well, good.
And a member of the Supreme Court Bar.
That's right. We have got so much to get to. Let's start off with the obvious. The obvious one is, I don't know if anybody saw this, it may have flown under your radar screen, but the Supreme Court made a series of decisions 2 weeks ago. One of them happened to be this thing on Obamacare. Obviously, nobody, and we tried handicapping this months ago, from saying that they were going to punt it, to they were going to have severability, to they were going to throw the whole thing out. I don't think any of us saw the ruling that came out of the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago. Bob, what do you think?
I think you're right. I think it was a surprise the way it happened. But I think it was also, to some degree, a stroke of genius on the part of the Chief Justice.
Let's talk about the future of Obamacare, and then I want to go into detail about why this was such a precedent case for the Supreme Court. But let's talk about the politics of Obamacare. Number one, for those who don't know, under less of a radar, the House is going to vote today, I believe, for the 31st time to try and repeal Obamacare. They're trying like hell, Al, to get the Democratic Obamacare program thrown out. Obviously, you don't think it's going to pass, and neither does the majority of Americans.
Not for the Senate. And I've been around long enough, as has Bob and Carl, to remember when the Republicans tried to do largely the same thing to Medicare and Medicaid. And now they've got the right-wing Tea Party people out saying, don't you let the government touch my Medicare, you know. So we've seen it all before. It is not a surprise that they will try to repeal it. It would be an incredible surprise if they succeeded.
Alan, you agree with that? You think that the fact that they're doing this for the 31st time is just almost Don Quixote-esque. But are they really jousting in a windmill that's not going to come down?
Not now. I mean, it's not going to come down now. The votes will be there in the House to overturn it. The Senate won't ever even get to it. And if for some miraculous reason it were to pass both, the president would veto it. So it's not going to happen now. If they're just setting this up to keep it in the forefront of people's minds for the election. Whether it's a big issue in the election, that remains to be seen.
Ralph, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, now the three branches of the U.S. government have spoken saying that Obamacare is constitutional. And regardless of the fact of whether you agreed with the decision of the Supreme Court or not, you should have Congress focusing on creating more jobs and working with the private sector rather than coming up with another repeal bill of Obamacare. It's just it's time that everyone just move forward.
Right, but Carl, when we look at this, I mean, obviously they're still partying over by the Supreme Court, at least Democrats are, as far as the ruling coming out the way it did. Politically, is this a big push or a big injection of help for a floundering Obama campaign that we'll get to here in a little bit? Was this a catalyst for the Obama campaign?
I think it's a good step in the right direction. Whether it's a catalyst, whether it's a push, who knows? We'll only know that in November. I can say this, that a friend of mine in New York, his interpretation was that Roberts did this so that he could give the Republicans an issue to run on. I think there were other reasons that Roberts did it, and I think one of them is, and not the best one, but one of them is that he didn't want to cause a disruption of what is already in place, and that is young people who don't have jobs, who are on their parents' insurance, and also for seniors, all the different examinations that they can get, annual examinations that have been paid, you know, for already free. So I think I was absolutely amazed and surprised by the decision, because I thought this is a slam dunk. I never really spoke about this publicly, but I thought this was a slam dunk that it was going to go against us.
But Tom Daschle in our friends over at Politico, Tom Daschle wrote back on the 8th, which was basically Sunday, wrote that the ruling itself gave the Affordable Care Act, as it's commonly referred to as Obamacare, quote, greater legitimacy and political standing. Bob, where's he going with that? I mean, Obamacare, at least in the majority of Americans, had legitimacy and political standing because they were talking about it every Sunday. But where's Tom Daschle going with this when he says that the decision gave it a lot more legitimacy and political standing?
Well, I think obviously any time the Supreme Court, on a major constitutional issue, renders a decision, that's a significant thing. There's no overruling the Supreme Court.
Especially when it's a surprise, and Carl wasn't the only one surprised by it.
Well, I think most Americans were surprised by it, but Alan Moore.
Regarding Daschle, little did we know that he was such a religious man, because this strikes me as a little bit of Daschle prayer, that maybe, just maybe, this will soften the issue. I don't think it does that at all. I think, and I do not in any way agree with Carl's friend that Roberts was sort of trying to do something politically to help Republicans. I completely think that is an absurd notion. I think what Roberts did do was quite interesting, but there were several pieces. He said it's not constitutional under the Commerce Clause, which is very important for the future, and he had a different 5-member majority who agreed with that. But he also said, and this has to do with the reputation of the court that he cares enormously about, that in his mind the court has a duty to find things constitutional that enjoy a lot of support in the legislature.
Well, I'm going to get to that, because we're going to talk about that in the next segment. But talking about Obamacare itself, it strikes me as being that now it's going to be harder. I mean, you're talking about a piece of legislation that a vast majority as a whole, the legislation as a whole, a vast majority of the American electorate disapprove of Obamacare, right, to the tune of 60 to 40.
But roughly, they like certain provisions in the Obamacare, like for the pre-existing conditions. 80% of Americans like the idea of having pre-existing conditions covered.
Right. But Congressman Al, go ahead.
That's the point. I think it's up to Obama to do something he has not been able to do up till now, and that is explain what's in the bill. This is a case of where the public, according to the polls, doesn't like Obamacare, but they like all kinds of things that are in it. The strategy, therefore, to change the public's mind is obvious, and he's just got to be able to do it. And so far, he hasn't demonstrated any ability to do that.
Possibly a week or 2 weeks to get out there and do just that, and they haven't done it. They haven't even started to do it. The other point I want to make is that I think that Roberts has seen in the United case, all the stuff that people said about the Supreme Court.
Well, I want to hold off on that thought, because I want to get to that here in the next segment. But Bob, go ahead.
Alan touched on it, and I want to go a little deeper into the rationale, because I think it is extremely important for long term. He said several things, Mr. Justice Roberts. First of all, he said that it wasn't the court's responsibility to like the statute or not. If they can find it constitutional, that's what they're supposed to do.
Right.
So wait a minute. Wait, just let me finish. What he said was that the Constitution's clause on the Commerce Clause, is not, a wide open door you can run anything through. It's a much more narrow package than the Democrats would like it to be. Long term, what this means, this decision, and this point turned the case, because the fundamental question was, what's the phrase?
Individual mandate.
The individual mandate is basically, he said, it's got to be a tax, because it can't be part of the something that under the
Commerce Clause. Well,
that is such an important point.
But does that point help or hurt Obama, Alan?
Well, for the moment, the Obama forces were jumping up and down. We won. We won. We won. And then it kind of drifts away. It charges up the Republicans. My own view is that from a purely political standpoint, this energizes Republicans a lot more, this decision, a lot more than it energizes Democrats. I don't know that will make the difference in November, but from a purely political standpoint, I think that's where the energy ends up. And now it also gives the Republicans a chance to say, it's a tax, call it what you want.
Congressman
it's
Al.
A tax.
Alan is correct up to a point. The point is that the president has...
I'm making progress.
To repeat myself, can the president sell the pieces of this? If he can, people won't care whether you call it a tax or a mugwump. If he can't, it's just one more thing they'll say.
Well, wait a minute. Congressman Al, let me ask you this question, though. I mean, the whole idea of Obamacare, a large part of the American electorate has been saying, look, this is an unfair tax being forced upon me by the federal government. That's what a majority of the Americans feel about Obamacare.
I think they feel it is something being forced on them. I don't know that they necessarily define it as a tax.
Well, anytime that the government forces you to pay into something and the Supreme Court ruled that it's not part of the interstate commerce clause, it's a tax.
I'm arguing the American public don't like to have things forced on them, and that, I think, is the primary objection.
And that begs the question, why hasn't Obama been able to sell Obamacare to the American people?
Boy, if you find the answer to that, will you please tell me, and I'll immediately run over to the Democrat.
Alan Moore.
Well, because it is extraordinarily complicated and takes a number of years to go into effect,
sure.
And we don't really know what all it means, which is why people will jump on, well, gee, everybody loves the fact that their kids can stay on their policy until they're 26. That's less than 1% of this bill, and Republicans agree with that.
Yeah.
So there are things that the public supports, and including Republicans. When they say we want to repeal, they also want to. They say they want to repeal and modify, restore,
but they're not really yeah.
not completely wipe out.
Bob Hines.
The point is, the Republicans are taking the position, repeal and replace. That's their idea now. If anybody knows what they want to put in replace, you
oh,
can.
Oh,
Nate. No,
wait a minute.
But the point is, that's a pretty good argument when nobody knows what's in the bill anyway.
But wait a minute. That brings up a good point here is, you know, is the fact that it is so convoluted that there are, you know, everybody in this town has their own opinion of what Obamacare truly is, what it truly encompasses. And there's a thousand different variations on this. Is there one single point that the Democrats can say, look, everybody needs this, even though it is and has been ruled a tax? Is there any way that the Obama administration can actually sell it as something other than a tax on the American people?
Well, the pre-existing conditions and also keeping your kids on health care.
But that doesn't solve the question of, is it a tax? It is a tax. They are raising the taxes on this.
I don't think that is going to be very important.
If you're a taxpayer making $23,000 in the eastern Oklahoma, it's a very important issue.
Republicans just love to use the word tax like it's a great big witch. Boo, tax. You know, and I don't think it has that kind of an impact when it's mixed in with healthcare, if the healthcare program is described properly.
But it's still, but Alan Moore, I'll let you take this one.
I actually agree with much of what my friend Al here says.
I retract it all.
He's thinking, what did I say?
Oh, my God. Wait a minute, Alan, I was going to go to you for contrary. What the hell?
Here's where I want to go with this. That tax as an issue tends to work for Republicans. So, yes, that's the little, the boogie-boogie thing that we got to enjoy watching Al do. But but here's the thing that frightens me. Here's Obama's challenge. How do you explain this, okay? Who's listening? Let me tell you about a poll that followed the Supreme Court decision by several days. The poll was, what did the Supreme Court decide? 40% of the American people said, I don't know. 20% of the American people said, they said it's unconstitutional.
Right.
60% knew nothing or were wrong. 40% knew it was constitutional. And if you probably dug into that group, you would have no consensus on what the real reasoning was. This is the American public. that we're trying to construct a that a president and a and his opponent are trying to construct messages for, they don't listen, they don't pay attention, they don't absorb what they hear. This is a huge challenge, and this is a really, really complicated bill that the six of us wouldn't agree on.
Bob Hines.
I think Obama has a problem because he's had a year and a half, approximately, to describe what it is. He has failed. The court's decision has only complicated the issue. The fact of the matter is he's not going to be able to use this as any big deal good thing because he can't explain it, and the Republicans will yell, now it would be unconstitutional if it wasn't a tax.
But
that he has got a tax here, and he tried to hide it from you, but now you know it's a tax.
But here's the question, though, and I'll go to Carl Tubin and Congressman Al on this one. Carl, I'll start with you. Now that he's gotten his Christmas list of saying, well, you know, it kind of is constitutional if you call it a tax, he's got another hurdle. He's got to implement this monster. How the hell is he going to implement something this large, this comprehensive, by 2014?
It's laid out in the bill. It's all laid out. There are steps in the bill that you know, different things happen at different times until it is all...
Congressman Al, you agree with that?
Well, bills like this always run into rocks in the road, even ones that are seemingly very simple. Something will come up and there is delay. So I wouldn't be surprised if it would take a little longer. But I don't see what that has to do with its effect on this election. You either believe in what it's going to do or you don't believe in what it's going to do. I don't think you're going to be debating when that would happen.
Yeah, there's another point. You've got a candidate running on the Republican side who passed a bill very, very similar to Obamacare, and he might have a 57-point plan as to what he's going to substitute for Obamacare, but nobody knows what the 57-point
plan is. I'd like to see him explain that.
No, but let's talk about this. This does go back to a lot of the Republican statements. When Romney did implement a universal health care plan in Massachusetts, he did that as a governor of a state, governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
I'm well aware of that.
Okay, but the reality is the Republicans have always said, look, don't force the states into something that we may not want. It may not fit for us. Basically, Obamacare has put in a one-size-fits-all solution. What Romney did was for a state, and it's states' rights to govern the health care of their own people. Is that not correct?
I understand all that, but let me tell you something. It has taken us a long time to get here, and a long time to finally implement some kind of health care system for the whole country. To go back, we'd probably have to wait 40 or 50 years. And prices would go, insurance prices, premiums would go sky high, people would be left out, left off, and we'd have the same problem that we have now, that people who are uninsured show up at the emergency rooms, and who pays the bill? We pay the bill.
Alan, would you like to take it?
That's still going to happen. There's still millions and millions of people who aren't in. I mean, the irony of all of this is that the penalty that you have to pay if you don't buy insurance is so modest that young, healthy people will say, I'm not going to buy $5,000 worth of insurance. I'll pay the $900 penalty or tax, as we now know that it is.
Yes.
The thing that's hard in all of this is, and it's a reminder of how little Americans understand our own Constitution, is the point you were making, and this was the whole Commerce Clause issue. This is an issue that states can do, the feds arguably cannot do, and the Supreme Court said it cannot do under the Commerce Clause, but oh look, it's got this penalty, we're going to call that a tax, and so we believe that makes it constitutional. Not necessarily a good idea.
But I give you Medicare and Medicaid. At Congressman Al.
I just want to address this tax thing. I listened very carefully to Nina Totenberg, who I think makes sense usually only on
her... Because you're a Democrat, that's why.
No, only on her topic, which is the Supreme Court, in which she explained that she and a number of other people who are knowledgeable about the court, that the tax was an inside the Supreme Court usage of the word, that it did not mean, as it was used by Roberts, what it means to the average public, so that the Republic is going to use the tax because it's impossible to explain what I just explained, and the Democrats can't use it. But the fact is, it's a fraud to say that this is basically a tax.
Rob Winnie.
What some analysts are saying is you pay a tax if you are, quote, a freeloader, unquote, under Obamacare. In other words, if you're trying to take advantage of someone else's health insurance, then you would pay a tax as a freeloader. Now, what's interesting is the Obama administration is going to try and say that over 600,000 jobs have been created in the healthcare sector after Obamacare was enacted. And how is that going to influence and impact the American people? It will just remain to be seen.
Well, we're coming up on a break here. This is obviously something that's still going to rear its ugly head, because next week we're going to talk about the vote that comes out at, probably after the show tonight. But when we do come back, I want to talk about the other side of this story, which is the ruling by the Supreme Court, which in the affirmative, headed up by Chief Justice John Roberts. Huge, huge, huge eruption of what the, huh? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah. Coming home until the fall, and then again I might not get home at all. Lulu's back in town. Oh, that woman's back in town. Oh my.
And we're back here live from Shelley's Back Room. Finally, 1331 F Street, the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue the discussion. By the way, in case you didn't hear it, because I didn't say it the first time, you can actually call in and join the conversation about Obamacare or anything we're talking about or anything political going on in the country. Call in at 877-662-3713. Again, toll free, 877-662-3713. We talked about the politics and we talked about Obamacare in total in the last segment. This segment I want to talk about why the decision was so monumental. why this decision, why everybody just scratched their heads when they actually saw it. I mean, even CNN came out and said, oh, it's thrown out, and they went, oh, crap, no, it's not. I'm going to start with Alan Moore this time. Alan, why was this such a surprise, and what took you back about it?
Well, it was a very unusual group of five. I was with a good friend who, when we first heard this, I was with a close friend who once clerked on the Supreme Court. So we had been talking about, we happened to be on a golf course at the time, but we were on our way and discussing, hey, today's the day. And
wow, way to act 1%, Alan.
So every now and then I get my moment. And it was like 5-4 Roberts, wait a minute, where's Kennedy? So the first thought was, how come Kennedy is not with the group? And then, oh, it's a tax. Wow, that's interesting. So it's not Commerce Clause. What's it all about? And on reflection, you realize that I think a factor that was important to Roberts was both what he said when he said, I think when the legislature speaks, we have a duty to seek a way for it to be constitutional if we can find one. And we find this one, and it works for a majority. Therefore, it's constitutional. If other people don't like it, so be it. But it was really interesting that he said no to the Commerce Clause provision. No, the federal government cannot order people to do this. No, the federal government cannot order people to install fuel-efficient windows or buy certain kinds of cars or certain kinds of food under the Commerce Clause. It can't do that. And it hasn't tried in the past, and this really shuts down ideas that might occur. Having said that, Roberts, is well aware that the court's reputation has been shaken some, particularly because of the lack of understanding, frankly, of Bush v. Gore back in the year 2000, and Citizens United, which I think most people don't really understand. It doesn't matter. The reputation of the court has been such that more and more people think that decisions are made on a partisan political basis. I don't happen to agree with that. I don't think anybody on the court believes that. But if the public believes it, that's a problem. And here was a way for him to maybe soften some of those fears and help the long-term reputation of the court in so doing.
Ralph, you're a member of the Supreme Court Bar. What surprised you?
I was surprised. Roberts went along and declared Obamacare as being constitutional, especially because the government attorney did a very poor job arguing the case before the justices.
Wow! But let's go back to Chief Justice Roberts and him writing in the affirmative. I mean, a lot of the people came back and said, okay, where's Kennedy? But when everybody saw the ruling and Chief Justice Roberts writing in the affirmative, Congressman Al, as a Democrat, that had to have given you pause as to saying, well, wait a minute. This doesn't make sense in many instances. He's a conservative justice. He was appointed by one of the most conservative presidents we've had in recent memory. What shocked you?
The part of it that made sense to me, and it took a while for it to sink in, and it took a while for me to listen to some commentary and what have you and mull it over, but it was that what I think makes it less surprising is what Russell just said.
Ralph.
Good old Joe across the table from me said about this being a court that needs to be brought back into balance in terms of the public's perception. So I think he started out with wanting to find it constitutional, and then, being a very good lawyer, he found a way to do it.
Congressman Al, let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
There has been one of the biggest concerns, biggest detractions of recent court rulings is that a lot of Americans feel that the Supreme Court may have been trying to legislate from the bench. Did this actually disprove that?
Well, one act doesn't disprove what's going to happen in the long term. But
it's a big act.
But it's a big part of the effort to try and neutralize the criticism of the court as being partisan.
Bob, you agree with that?
Well, I think the decision is, I think it's part the fact that the Chief Justice felt the institution of the court had a problem, and if he could not only find a reason to keep to make the statute constitutional, that would be a plus. I think he felt it would also, he also wanted to find a way, which he did, to make sure that the Commerce Clause did not become just an open door, which I think long term may be almost as important as any single thing that's happened in a long time. So from that standpoint, I think the court decision is one of the most important decisions we probably had in a heck of a long time.
Alan, when Chief Justice Roberts came out with the decision, and in his brief wrote that, you know, hey, I don't, and I'm going to paraphrase, hey, I don't like this as much as any other possible Republican, but my job is to rule on the legality of this.
Well, he didn't say he didn't like it. He said,
I may not agree with it.
We are not speaking on the merits. That's for others to decide. We are speaking on the question of whether it's constitutional, and we believe that it is, and here's why. But he purposefully and intentionally separated himself, and the majority, for that matter, from the merits. So it throws it back into the election in a big way and allows people to say, the court says it's constitutional. The court doesn't like it. We don't like it. Throw these bums out, and then we can totally replace it with something better.
Al, Congressman Al.
I think one of the really interesting things that will come down the road in the future is how this puts Roberts perhaps in conflict with the ultra-conservative.
Scalia.
Because what Roberts is saying is the court's job is to try and find a way that the legislative branches of government can do what they want to do. And Scalia takes the view regularly that I don't care what the Congress meant. It's what the words say, and I have divined what Benjamin Franklin was thinking and John Adams was thinking, and that's what we have to interpret.
Well, Bob Hines, I mean, Al brings up a very solid point. I mean, when you look at the four, it includes the sometimes conservative, sometimes liberal Justice Kennedy, who was appointed by a Republican president. We look at the four who wrote in the negative, in the dissension. Was Roberts being part of the front five? Was it a political maneuver, do you think, going off of maybe what Carl was saying?
No, I don't. I don't think it's a political maneuver. No, I think it was. Take for example, the week before the Arizona case came down, another big case. When I saw that Kennedy had written that decision, I knew that Roberts had written the Obamacare.
Really?
Oh yeah.
How so?
Well, because the Chief Justice is going to pick the case he needs. He's going to write that he feels is the most important one he wants. And when Kennedy took the issue of the state is against the government on immigration, when Kennedy did that, I knew it was Roberts for the Supreme Court. I did not know what he was going to do, but I knew from what he had said that he did not like the idea of the Commerce Clause. And if you go back and you look, and I haven't looked, but I've been told that, you know, there was in the argument, in some of the arguments, that very casually people talked about the question of, you know, this could be a tax.
Well,
this
I mean,
might be a tax. So in effect, Robert saw that, and he was looking for a way to do it, because I think his view is,
was the tax, let me go this far, was the tax issue an escape clause for Roberts to write in the affirmative?
Yeah.
You think so?
I do not believe. Based on what he said about the constitutional structure of the Commerce Clause, I do not believe that he would have ever voted for the Commerce Clause being
you know, an open door for anything to run through it.
Now, Carl Tooman, you were saying earlier about this that you thought it was political motivation
Not that it was political. I mean, I agree with Alan and what Alan enunciated, and that is that he looks at his court, and he knows that his court has a bad reputation for Citizens United and for other cases, and therefore he tries to see a way where he can bend over and do something, and then I think he takes into consideration all the other things we've said, the children who would be bumped off of the parents' care and all the other things, and he makes this decision, he makes this ruling, and goes with the majority of the liquors.
You're looking at the totality of the circumstance,
yeah,
which is very important when you're analyzing these kind of cases.
Well, but Alan Moore, go ahead.
I was with you there, Carl, until you got into the details of some of the provisions in the act itself. I really don't think that was a concern of theirs, what Obamacare does. I think that that he covered that by saying we're not speaking to the merits here. The question before the court is this bill constitutional, and not just the mandate, but
the entire bill.
There were some other provisions, one of which the court threw out, relating to Medicaid. Really important to the states. But there were separate questions before the court, and the one we're talking about is whether the bill was constitutional. A majority said it's not under the Commerce Clause, but
as a tax,
it is under the taxing authority that resides in the Constitution. Therefore, it's constitutional. We're not speaking to the merits. We're not looking at the merits. They are irrelevant to our decision.
But bottom line,
he specifically said it is not our job to pass judgment on the appropriateness of what the bill is. That's the legislator's responsibility. Our question is the constitutionality.
That's where he's going to have trouble with Scalia.
Yeah,
right.
He will.
Right. Well, but here's the other question, though.
But it's a good point.
But there was a story.
It is a good point.
There was a story in the Washington Post by Jan Crawford Greensburg, where she wrote and said that this actually, in her opinion, weakens the court in its independence by showing that the chief can and will bow to political pressure. I bring that up because number one, there are people that are saying, well, wait a minute, it was Chief Justice looking at there's two seats that are going to be coming open, possibly under a Democratic presidency, that there is some political pressure to make this reality. I don't agree with that, but is there any substance to that argument, Congressman Al?
That is a disappointed Republican who isn't paying attention. I'm a Democrat, and I have disagreed with the Chief Justice on a lot of things. I have not found them to be, many of them, to be partisan. I just don't agree with them. But I don't think they were partisan when they
Alan
motivated.
Moore.
I'm going to keep agreeing with Al. I don't think these guys are partisans. Their whole history is not to be partisans. Their history is to be Supreme Court clerks, judges. There's not a politician among them, and we want to ascribe political motives. There are different views of the Constitution and how it works and what it allows, and we see it over and over and over again. It comes out. You can apply an ideological motive if you want to, but I think over time that ideology isn't what it's about. It's views of the court and the Constitution that dominate, and that's where these differences are.
These are conservative justices. They're going to give conservative opinions.
Well, I disagree with that, Al. I mean, because if you look at where
let me finish. I said conservative. I didn't say Republican.
That's exactly right.
But to expect a bunch of liberals to suddenly vote conservative, as often Republicans do, and a bunch of conservatives to vote the other way as Democrats do, is just simply wrong. There's only one vote that they had taken that I think was partisanly driven, and that was Gore versus Bush.
I would happily debate that. We're going to.
But my point is that the rest of them, a whole bunch I disagreed with, but I'm a liberal and they're conservatives, and you expect that.
Alan Moore, I want you to talk about a little bit about Al's assertion that Bush v. Gore was politically driven.
Well, to give it proper attention, you really have to dig into what they decided. But in ever so brief reminder,
which I know is difficult for you.
It's so difficult, it's probably impossible, but know that my heart is there. In Bush v. Gore asked for a recount in a certain number of counties. Not statewide, a certain number of counties where he was strong and thought he might be stronger. The Supreme Court of Florida said, okay,
that's
we'll
fine
go along
by
with
us.
That. And that was challenged as unconstitutional because it was treating different parts of the state in a different way. If they wanted to recount, they had to recount everything, not just something. Now, the outcome was if you went with the Florida Supreme Court, you were going to end up with a Gore presidency, and it almost certainly, and not a Bush presidency. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do it that way. And no one was at that point proposing to do the entire state. That was what Bush v. Gore was. Al and I may disagree what was motivating them, but I believe that they felt, no, we are not going to let a much more political state Supreme Court than we have as a federal Supreme Court make a judgment that almost certainly is going to favor the Democrat in the pivotal state. That we're not going to allow. Now, what happened was a different outcome.
Do I disagree with that? Let me count the ways.
Okay. because this does call into question the politicalization of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, I think this is the first ruling, in my opinion, that the Supreme Court has truly gone back to the basis of the tricameral system, where you have Congress to legislate, the chief executive to be just that, the chief executive, and the Supreme Court to rule what is constitutional and not constitutional in the laws that are passed by Congress and enacted by the president.
First one I recall as well, though I'm not
sure. First one of what? That's what they do all the time, guys.
Well,
that's what their role is. That's what they do. You just don't like the outcome.
I want to back up, Al, on one thing. The perception of the court legislating from the bench, and this is in large part driven by the media that we deal with, there is and has been for a while a perception since Bush v. Gore that there has been a certain legislative agenda by the Supreme Court. Those in the know realize that that's not true. This, I think, put out any sort of question that this is a political entity. It's not a political entity. It is the highest legal entity in the land.
I wish I thought you were right. That is, that this puts it out of the question.
It'll be back on it. Oh, I'm sure it will be.
But I agree that this had some softening, or at least a moment of that. And now, we should let Ralph. Ralph was down in Florida, as I remember.
I was down in Florida for Bush v. Gore. You got to remember, the Supreme Court justices in Florida are elected, statewide election. And your biggest electoral base are retirees in South Florida who tend to vote Democratic.
And Al wanted them to decide the election in 2000.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Fair. We're talking about Al Gore.
No, we're talking about you, Al.
Al Gore and his good friend. Friend and shadow.
And advisor. And legal advisor.
His wingman.
Yeah. All of a sudden now he's got a JD. That's amazing. Exactly. Ralph, you had a comment?
I was gonna say, I think... there's a lot of reports out that certain right-wing groups were trying to influence Justice Roberts to declare the Obamacare as unconstitutional. And kudos to Justice Roberts for looking at it based on the rule of law.
Well, the other big story to come out of this is that the second that they found out that Chief Justice Roberts had written in the affirmative, several very right-wing organizations were calling for his impeachment.
Right.
Which, ironically, you know, impeaching the Chief Justice for arguably doing his job.
Well, that's just going to backfire.
That sure took off. Had a lot of laughs.
Yeah, that lasted all of 10 seconds.
And it would have been as successful as impeaching Earl Warren.
Right. Well, that actually brings up my last question for the segment is, did Justice Roberts make a name for himself? Are we always going to remember, like we do the Warren Court, like we do some of the other notable Chief Justices? Will we always remember the Roberts Court from now on?
I you're asking me to project years in advance, and that's impossible. But my gut says no, that there will be other things that will come along.
Carl Toobin.
Yeah, the Warren Court and Justice Warren deserves all the acclaim he had for a series of decisions, which he offered and other justices offered at that time. Now, a lot of the conservatives were angry at that. I don't know whether they were conservative or middle conservatives, but that's how the Warren Court got the reputation. They were an activist court, and they did a lot of things that were good for the country.
So you're saying that the Warren Court is an activist court?
Yeah,
Did they legislate from the bench, do you think? Bob Hines.
First of all, it's going to take more significant decisions for the Roberts Court to be identified as something. Now, with respect to what we were just talking about, you know, look, it depends on the cases. I mean, the Warren Court was acting on the cases they got. You can't just make up a case and give it to the court. There's got to be a reason that goes to the Supreme Court. Usually it's got to roll up through all the federal systems. Or if it's a state issue, the state can ask as Arizona did to have the court rule on their immigration project. So the fact of the matter is, whatever the court's going to be is unclear at this time in the future. What decisions are going to be there over the next decade is the question you'd have to answer. If you know what those cases were, you'd be able to get an idea whether it's going to be a significant court or not. It's obviously got some strong-minded people on it, so that's the kind of a thing that often leads to interesting decisions.
See, one question, and I'll put it out there. I'll start with you, Congressman Al. As a former member of Congress, did the Roberts decision push Congress maybe to take a little bit more of a proactive role in ensuring the constitutionality of the laws that they pass?
No,
really.
If we'd had a Congress that we had 10, 15 years ago, I would have said yes. Until this Congress becomes less partisan on both sides, until the fringes stop running the joint rather than the moderates, then I think the answer is no.
Alan.
I agree with Al. Again, still again.
Jeez, why do we even have you here?
I agree with him on the bottom line. I don't know about 10 or 15 years ago. But the 15 years I spent working in the Senate, I remember numerous times where a piece of legislation would move forward or someone would consider an amendment and somebody might say, is that constitutional? And we might even discuss it a little bit. And then but ultimately the answer was always, that's not our problem. We don't want to just willy-nilly do something that's clearly unconstitutional because it will never pass. But some of these things are close calls. If it's challenged in court, the courts will decide. It's not up to us. It's not our job to make that judgment whether it's constitutional. That happens in the courts. The Supreme Court is the last word on that. We're going to move ahead if we like this idea, and we're not going to worry that much about that.
Bob Hines?
That's the way it should be. The legislature's job is to write laws that they think will solve a specific problem.
The court system is there to make sure that within the framework of the Constitution, the law that has been written and is on their table looking at them, they know where they're
But does it make sense for Congress to put together a law that they know is going to be challenged in court, signed by the, by a seated president? Does it make sense for them to push something knowing that it'll be overturned eventually?
No. The point is, the Congress and the administration wanted to write a health care bill. They wrote a health care bill. That's their legislative job. Now, we can all around this table have different views about the efficacy of it or the constitutionality of it or whether it was just good policy. But the court's job is to say, is it constitutional or not? And Alan has just expressed very well one the way the Congress ought to be looking at it. The other side is to judge what Robert said. Our job is not to pass a judgment on the efficacy of the policy, only the constitutionality.
Ralph, I agree with Bob, and I think the Democrats' talking points are going to be is they want to build on the reforms of the Affordable Health Care Act, move forward, and not talk about what has already been litigated time and again.
Carl Toobin.
You know, all the lawsuits came from very conservative people who wanted to tear down the president and tear down the law. There was one liberal attorney general that filed suit against Obamacare, which was all conservative attorney generals and other groups that filed suit. And I think that says volumes about, you know, about the reason why this got all the way up to the Supreme Court so quickly.
Well, what it says is that the liberal establishment and the liberal universe of in America wants a national health care bill. That's a policy question. And
right. Congressman Al,
your original question was: does it have any effect? Its potential unconstitutionality on the legislative process. And I remember something in the little House Administration Committee that I chaired on campaign finance reform. And there was huge problems in doing something fairly simple because of earlier Supreme Court judgments. And I got so frustrated, I said to my chief of staff, I said, why don't we just go ahead and do this and force the
courts to tell me no?
Yeah, you use courts, that's a good word. I was going to use a more definitive one. And just force
them. Well, better not start with that.
Yeah.
Force the court.
Does it rhyme with luck
to say that? And force. This is to be short.
Oh,
and force the court to come down and say that the way we were doing things was okay. He said, and if I could give him a retroactive raise for this insight, I would. This is now 20 years ago. He said, not only will they find it unconstitutional, but this court will go back and wipe out the whole thing. Well, he was 20 years too soon. That's exactly what the court did when it really got a chance to decide on campaign finance. And so, yes, we didn't do it because we were afraid of the Supreme Court.
Alan, I'm going to give you the last
report. Yeah, there are definitely cases where, in subject matter, and that's a really good one, a good example, where you do tread carefully. With regard to, regarding constitutionality, regarding the health care reform bill, though, I will never forget when a report, after it was passed, constitutionality was not a big question in the course of the debate. A reporter asked, kind of a fringe reporter, as I recall, asked Speaker Pelosi, is this constitutional? And she thought, she looked at him like he
weird.
Was crazy,
yeah.
An idiot. You know, like, of course, what's the problem? And no one was thinking at that point about, is this going to be an issue? And then it took on a big life of its own, and then that became the major focus. But the real question here, now that we know it's constitutional, is what about the merits?
All right. Carl, I'm going to give you the last word.
I just want to say there was another case decided that same day after the Obamacare, and it was about a veteran who was walking around saying, I got this medal, I got that medal, I got this medal, everything else.
And it was the constitutionality of the Heroes Act.
Right, right. And the court, instead of ruling against this person, said that under the free speech, he had a right to say this. And it threw the veterans community into a tizzy.
Right. Right. Oh, good point. Good point. It's happy hour, so that means that we can order martinis, get our cigars, and we're going to be back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room here in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt. Anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays. One more once, we're back here at Shelley's Back Room. All of us together, all of us happy, and all of us back in the groove. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're going to change gears right now. The other big news coming out of Washington happened last week, last Friday, when the jobs numbers for the month of June came out, and everybody at the White House just hanging their head in for what can be called, we'll call it sucky numbers coming out of the jobs report. Basically, the bottom line is unemployment still hanging at 8.2%, and there's no real job growth going around. Number one, how big of a kick in the gut was this to the Obama camp? Congressman Al, start with you.
It's a big one.
Why?
Because, obviously, if excuse me, if joblessness grows, excuse me, it's bad for any incumbent running for re-election. And what he wants those figures to do is to go down, and it didn't happen. So he's still got, you know, more time, but that wasn't a welcome happening.
Carl Tooven.
Well, you know, they were a little bit better than they were the month before.
That's not saying
that
much.
That doesn't say much. Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. That doesn't say much. But, you know, you have to look at, in my mind, you have to look at what Obama has done over the last 3 years, almost 4 years, and taking over an economy that was really in the dumps. And putting in the stimulus, which probably should have been more, to create more jobs, but couldn't get that done. Saved the car industry, which is doing very, very well now. I don't necessarily, and I have to look at the Obama family. People like the president, they like Michelle, they like the kids, they like the dog. and I think that some of this will be overcome by their feelings for the president. And we'll have to wait and see what happens in November.
Hold on. I want this on record, okay? Happy hour is sanctity in this room. And Congressman Al, we give you one task. Order our happy hour drinks. And my, have I been gone that long that you didn't order my drink?
Yes.
Okay. Valid point. That works. Ralph, you had a comment.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the job numbers are not good, and you have the Romney campaign feeling that because the economy is bad, that people are automatically going to blame Obama and vote him out of office. But the reality that they're facing is you have 20% of the American voters don't think Romney has any plans for building the economy, which is going to make it difficult for the challenger to become a president. And the Romney campaign has been very slow to respond to the Bain attack and to the notion that Mitt Romney is out of touch with the average American voter.
Well, let's go back to the job numbers. You know, when Alan Moore, when we look at those job numbers, obviously the Republicans have got an entire sheet of weaponry to come out against the Obama campaign. 8.2, as long as it stands there, a lot of political insiders are saying it's going to be tough at this stage to get the president reelected, at least.
Listen, the economic results of this presidency have been a disaster. Whether it's the president's fault, fate, Europe, doesn't really matter. The situation really is disastrous. Last month was one more bad month. I was intrigued with Carl's notion that it wasn't as bad as the month before. And I'm thinking, okay, this month was a kick in the gut, and last month was a kick in the privates. I mean,
you can say kick in the nuts. That's fine.
You know, the opportunity is there for Romney to win. But the bottom line is he's going to have to be able to show that he can relate to the average American voter, and he's got to put a plan of action into place that's going to convince the American voter that he has the know-how and the plan to straighten out the economy.
Alan Moore.
56% of American people in a poll this week think that the country is worse off in the course of the Obama presidency. That is a staggering number. They like him. His wife, kids, and dog, yes. They like him more than they like Romney, which is, you know, what it is. But popularity as a person, the guy you'd like to have a beer with, doesn't get you reelected. There is clearly an opportunity for Romney. I think the challenge for him is to have a coherent plan of some sort of what he would do differently, rather than to say, I'm a business guy, I know how to create jobs. He's got to have some kind of economic plan that people can understand, relate to, in contrast with what the president
does. But it does have right now.
Fine old port with the Romney instead of the beer.
Are you talking about the one percenter, really? You're really going to go there, Congressman,
yeah,
Al?
On his boat.
On his speedboat? Okay, good job, Alan. Bob Hines.
I agree with Alan that Mr. Romney is going to have to come up with something positive and solid that people get a handle on. Right now, Obama's leading in Ohio by 6 or 7 points. He's leading in Pennsylvania by about 5. He's leading in Florida by 7 or 8. I mean, the numbers are not good for Mr. Romney in some really key states. He has to win Florida and Ohio, most likely, and he's trailing in both of them.
But at the same time, though, there was a poll released today that was conducted by, I think it was ABC and the Washington Post, that said when it came to who could best manage the economy, 56% of the Americans said it would be Romney versus 43% for Obama. Is that a definitive margin?
Well, no, it's one poll. Let's see what happens. I don't know. I mean, I suggested a couple of states that have had several polls, and the numbers are not good for Mr. Romney. Now, I think he can certainly... it's not nearly too late to do it, but he needs to have something that he can show the public, because it's true. I mean, the president owns the economy right now, and he's not doing a darn thing in the eyes of an awful lot of people to help.
Alan Moore.
And I, with regard to the Romney message, I'll remind everybody of one thing. He's raising all this money. He's outraising the president right now, but he can't spend yet a lot of his money until he's nominated. So most of we see a lot of Obama messaging on TV, including here in the D.C. area, which is a little bit odd, but we're seeing it.
Waste your money.
And it's Obama ads. It's not third-party ads. It's not PAC ads. And Romney money is not being spent yet. He's accumulating it. He's saving it. And we're going to see a lot of money spent after the election, all this $106 million just last month that he raised. The key question is there going to be a credible message that will make sense to people? The opportunity is clearly there. But the opportunity was there 8 years ago for John Kerry to beat a very unpopular at the time George Bush, and he lost. So just because the opportunity is there doesn't mean you're going to pull it off.
Ralph Whitty.
And Romney can't get mirrored down in this whole issue of his offshore bank accounts. And what does he know? Where is this particular money located? What kind of companies have been set up? It's taken away from Romney's message that he can fix the economy.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because factcheck.org took a look at a couple of the ads being put out by both camps. And the one ad that factcheck.org, which is nonpartisan and pretty fair and balanced, if you want to use the Fox News term, they actually came out and said that the Obama ad that claims that he was responsible for outsourcing to China and to Mexico was completely, not just wrong, but completely unfounded. It was just them making up stuff. Is that a sign that the Obama camp might be in a little bit of chaos right now?
Well, they thought they had a winning issue with this outsourcing business, thanks to a greatly exaggerated and not very well understood prominent story in the Washington Post. They took that story and ran with and they enhanced it, ran with it, and factcheck.org said,
no,
it doesn't work. And here's why, and you can go and look at it. There's a whole host of issue, a whole host of problems with it. But what it's created now is an interesting backlash by the Romney people saying, you want to talk outsourcing? Let's talk about the jobs that have left America's shores during the Obama presidency. He's now being called the outsourcer in chief. He has not taken on the tax in a big way, in an aggressive way, the so-called tax laws that support outsourcing. And all that refers to is the fact that if you earn money overseas, you don't have to pay taxes in the U.S. until you bring the profits back. And now there's a lot of work going on to say, oh, you're wrong about Romney in a few hundred jobs here and there, but let's talk about the hundreds of thousands of jobs that have moved to China just in the last 4 years.
But Congressman Al, I mean, for the Obama camp, with especially people like David Axelrod leading the way on this, that strikes me as being odd for an incumbent president to do that kind of sloppy political work. Does that shock you a little bit?
No. I was shocked months and months ago about the inability of this White House to get its message out or to even formulate a cogent message that could be simply explained. I think they've had the messages out, but it's always been not very effective. So the fact that he now can't do it doesn't surprise me. It alarms the hell out of me.
Bob Hines.
Hear, hear.
Well, you know, the president owns the economy. It isn't good. I don't think that there's much that he can do about that at all. I mean, anybody at this table thinks he can do very much about it. I'm sure that if his advisors could find a way to do something about it, they would. He's going to be able to play around the edges and do some things, but he's got a problem that is very, very difficult to overcome. And I don't know that better messaging is going to help him if a month from now the next jobs bill, the next jobs problem is 8.2 unemployment. That's the kind of stuff that is just going to kill him.
But in the president's defense, though, Carl Toobin, we're not losing jobs the way we were. But we still don't hear anything about that coming out of the Obama camp. Why is that?
Again, it's part of messaging. I mean, you know, for a group of people who did so well 4 years ago in promoting their candidate and getting him across and winning the election, and then to go into an administration, I mean, there's been bad messaging from the beginning. Al's right. And after health care was passed, they didn't sell it, or they didn't sell it adequately. I mean, nothing has worked in their messaging since January of whatever it is. Anyway,
2009.
If they put Carl Toobin and I in charge, they'd be running a better campaign.
Oh, okay.
That's
Alan Moore.
I love this conversation about bad messaging. There's nothing there. The economy is in the toilet. This is lipstick on a pig that they're talking about.
Hold on. Carl, hold on. Al Twitt first.
Well, I mean, Carl listed a little while ago all the things, the automobile industry.
Well, let's talk about the auto industry.
Hold on, Alan.
There are all kinds of things that you can talk about, and obviously that the Republicans can rebut. But they're not talking about them, and it's not because the Republicans can rebut them.
Right.
They're not putting a message together that is connecting with the public.
But Al, I mean, going back to Alan's point is, you know, he was talking about change. He was talking about hope. We're going to make the economy better. We're going to fix these problems of unemployment and jobs. We're going to create more jobs. They passed a stimulus bill that was supposed to create more jobs. That didn't work. I mean, arguably, there really is nothing there to message out, according to Alan Moore.
Well, several points. One, things I believe would be a hell of a lot worse had it not been for the stimulus package and a number of things that he did. And remember that he started from a hole that was dug by his predecessor, not by Mr. Obama. So I think that you got to get back to messaging, and he's just not doing it right.
Bob Hines.
Stimulus package is old hat. Big deal. What are you doing now? What's going on today? How come I haven't got a job? How come my wife doesn't have a job? What's going on? I mean, that's the problem right now that the president faces.
I completely agree with that. But if he had made a big deal out of it at the time, there'd be a lingering benefit to that.
I think he did make a pretty big deal out of it. And I think it helped him in that first year, 18 months. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that only lasts so long, and there's been nothing since. And I think it's profoundly difficult right now. I don't think it's necessarily a weak message or, you know, not well put together. I don't care who's sitting in that office trying to look at the economy right now and divine what would be a positive message that people would respond to and say, by God, the guy's doing everything he can. I'm not sure that there's a way to do that that would stand credibility. I think he's just in there, and he's hoping the darn thing will get better.
Alan Moore.
Well, and last week, recently, it's been interesting because the president's pretty good with not stepping his foot into it. But last week he said, or just the other day he said, you know, I've been trying really hard. Doesn't every president? That was a pathetic thing. And a week before that, he said, well, the private sector's doing fine, trying to make a case for his bill to funnel more money to the states. And this business of blaming what he inherited, let's remember one thing about the last 2 years of the Bush administration. The Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. So, now, having said that, if John McCain were president today, would we be better off? Not necessarily. Would we be a lot worse off? Not necessarily. That's something we don't know. And to some extent, he did inherit a mess, and you can't just fix anything overnight, no matter how many billions or trillions you spend, because we've spent trillions. But it's on him. It's his economy. And he can't escape it. What he's trying to do is divert attention to that, and to attack Romney personally. But it's a pretty weak message, and there's nothing. He's not talking about what he's for, and it's Romney's problem too.
Carl Toobin.
You know, the Democrats in the Congress when we were going through the financial crisis, which saw Lehman Brothers go down, which was really a competition between the Secretary of the Treasurer and the head of Lehman Brothers, who hated each other. And that's why Lehman Brothers went down. One of the reasons. And that screwed up all the credit markets, both here and in foreign countries. When we came in, the economy was a heck of a lot worse than they were told it was. And they found a mess on their hands. And they did the best that they could do to try to bring it back. And it takes time in a recession to bring it back. And
yeah, but I refer you back to the recession 2002-2003. Right after the attacks, we went into a deep recession. And we came out of that in 2005 in 2 years.
But we didn't
Obama's had 4 years.
We didn't have the real estate bubble burst, and we didn't have the banks going wild. And
we were creating the real estate bubble at that time.
Well, we were.
We were riding this artificial wave, which helped us.
Hold on, Bob Hines.
It may be, as Carl says, and I think he accurately represents what was going on at the time of the last election. It was a difficult time. But the point is, that's 3 years plus go. I mean, the economy is owned by the president, you know, after let's say 18 months for sure. And it's just there's not a lot that he can do. I grant that. I don't know if a genius could come back and suddenly figure something out. But the fact of the matter is, whether there is ability to really do something, or you just have to weather it out and hope you can survive, the fact of the matter is, it's a real big difficulty. He doesn't have a message. He doesn't have anything he can say except, you know, look at this and look at that, little small items. This is not going to be enough.
I think the bottom line is Obama's going to have to deflect the public's attention away from the economy and focus on Mitt Romney, the fact that Mitt Romney is out of touch with the average American, the Bain scandal, and the issue with the offshore accounts, and at the same time hope to boost Latino turnout because of Obama's new immigration position.
Carl Steuben, you had one last point.
I think also that during this campaign, we're going to find running against the Republican House is going to be a big deal here. The Tea Party has practically held up anything and everything they could, which would have helped the economy. And they have control over the speaker. They have control over Cantor, and it's been a mess.
I disagree with that, Carl.
You're right.
I absolutely.
You're right. I feel
we all do.
But yeah, well, no,
we
I
all
no,
don't.
No. Al doesn't. Al doesn't disagree. I will say this.
I mean, it's 4-2 here, but at least it's a fighting two.
What I will say though is that, you know, if you sit there and you look at, you know, the economy, you know, somebody brought up, I think it was you brought up the failure of Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers failed because of bad investments.
Yeah.
Point blank. They were allowed to make bad investments, those investments that they called the tab on it, and they said no.
Lehman Brothers wanted money from the federal government to be able to try to stay alive.
Hank Paulson, the biggest friend of investment bankers in the history of any Secretary of the Treasury, came out and said, "Look, I can't save you." Even in the book Too Big to Fail, Hank Paulson is quoted saying, "I can't save Lehman Brothers."
Probably
it wasn't a personality conflict.
No.
Let's not go there.
Too much in the weeds.
Goldman Sachs people that were in the Treasury Department at that time with him, and they hated the head of
As a former shareholder in Lehman Brothers, could we move on from this subject?
Sensitive subject for you, but obviously, you know, we look at a lot of the economy, saving the banking system, was arguably done by originally Hank Paulson, but implemented by Timothy Geithner, who at that time was chairman of the New York Fed.
New York Fed,
and
avoiding taxes in his own right.
We can get into that in another discussion. But I want to go to Al Swift. When you look at the bottom line here is the Obama administration's had 4 years to fix the economy. He's tried to implement programs in the economy that have just not sparked that kind of investment. Banks now have a lot more money to invest, but they're holding on to it, not being comfortable with the Obama administration's ability to manage the economy. How does the Obama administration overcome that hurdle?
Well, they could take a run at the Supreme Court and just tell the banks they have to lend some of that money. And by the time it got through the Supreme Court, it would have been lent and the economy would be improved. How's that for a fairy tale? I admit that's a fairy tale. But
what kind of pixie dust did they put in your martini, dude?
But the fact I'm getting at here is that presidents have very limited abilities to move the economy. I've always thought that Herbert Hoover got jobbed in terms of his reputation back then. He may have been trying to do the wrong things, who knows, but the things that FDR did took a decade or more, took the World War II to really grab a hold. So the fact that he's going to be blamed for it is true. Every president is blamed or given credit for the economy, and no president has had much to do but for the economy, good or bad.
We have a caller right now. Call us 203 years ago. What's your question? Caller?
Hello?
Yes, call. Yeah, with Backroom Politics.
No, I've just dialed in. I haven't heard anything yet.
Okay, so we'll put you back on hold.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Let me. I'd like to throw in an observation, and you mentioned earlier, just briefly, that Obama promised change. And I have to tell you, I cringed when that came out as one of the big things, because change is the hardest thing to do in this city.
And try hope.
And there's a reason for it, and that is because it's largely is going to run the way it's going to run, and there's not much you can do about it. But I remembered this. Truman said at one point, as he was leaving the White House, he said of Eisenhower, he said, he's a general. He's going to issue an order, and he's going to think that it's going to be obeyed. He will be very surprised.
One thing that's important to mention is Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF, has now got on the record criticizing Geithner and the Obama administration, saying that we, the U.S., needs to get our fiscal situation in order and to stop lecturing the Europeans on fiscal management and policy.
And she sure does have a point. I mean, we're really good at bossing around other countries, telling them what to do, telling them what they have to do, and things that would make a lot of sense here in America that, of course, we don't do.
Yeah, right. And we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world now. Japan finally lowered theirs.
Well, I'll tell you something.
We're number one in something.
Yeah, that's right. When we come back, I'm gonna go on a soapbox for a second because I can because
I'm moderator.
Stand back, everybody.
Stand back, everybody.
Know that it'll hold.
Well, oh wow, weight jokes, really, Al? Wow, way to go, old man. You have a great grandson, right?
I guess I'm trying to lose
civility. Yeah, exactly. Civility. When we come back, I'm going to go on a little bit of a soapbox, so stay with us if you want to hear my rant. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the side of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
And we're back here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Soapbox time, so you guys are going to have to deal with me. I got to tell you something. Just for background, so everybody knows what's been going on. The reason why I have not been here. Why is everybody moving out from my soapbox? Oh, good Lord. They're like, all of a sudden I said soapbox, and they're like out the door. So for
we allowed to jeer during this?
Yes, you can jeer. Okay. There will be comments. So here's the soapbox, folks. The reality is, the reason why I was not here for the past 3 months is the fact that I've been running a congressional campaign out in Oklahoma for a dear friend of mine. Now, a lot of people are going to say that this is just, mean loser, bad loser, bad sport.
Sour grapes,
however you want to call it, Alan, that's fine. The reality is, it struck me that, and we've talked about this on the show before, that the electorate is swayed by media and by 30-second sound bites and 30-second ads more so than doing research on who they're electing to represent them. There is a huge problem in this country of people being lazy and almost complacent in the way that they elect the people representing them in Washington. It is a bad problem. I give you an example. The race for the open congressional seat for Dan Boren, outgoing Congressman Dan Boren, in Oklahoma's 2nd District. The guy I was with, Dakota Wood, he's been a guest on the show several times. Dakota Wood did not make it in the runoff. It was a 6-way race. It's a tough district. But the guy who took the most votes is a guy who, A, was quoted this week he was quoted at a forum saying, I am in favor of the single payer plan, which is right now, that's Obamacare.
Yeah.
That's the individual mandate. He came out and said on video, I'm in favor of the single pay system, and I'm in favor of Medicare for everybody. When he was questioned about it, because that pretty much goes in favor of Obamacare.
So it's a liberal point of view.
It's
to the left of Obamacare.
It's very much to the left of Obamacare. This guy was questioned. He held a press conference saying he was taken out of context, which the video does not show. He basically came out and said, when we talk about health care, I am in favor of the single payer plan. When he was asked about it, they said, if you're taken out of context, do you know what the single payer plan is? He came out and said, and I'm paraphrasing, no, I've been on the campaign trail for 9 months. I don't know what the single payer plan is. You're running for Congress, one of the most divisive issues in this country, and you're coming out and saying you don't have a clue as to what you're talking about. Yet they still put votes in this guy's cauldron. My soapbox is that if we don't change the way that this country elects and we don't take some individual responsibility in the way that this country actually goes and elects the people who represent us in Washington, we are not going to change the situation we have here in Washington that keeps everything in a logjam. I don't know if you agree with that or disagree with that.
No, I go a little bit farther. I think we need to change some of our institutional structure to make it work. I think
such as?
I think that the idea of nominees being selected by conventions rather than by a broader vote is a change that needs to be made. I think that the jurisdictions in which people run should be drawn in a more objective fashion. We have too much gerrymandering going on. I think that a lot of the things that have been passed in Congress as reforms have only institutionalized what was wrong rather and covered it up with a little bit of thou shalt not, and not letting former congressmen come into the House gym that's a huge change. I mean, it's nothing, absolutely nothing.
Alan Moore, I'm
going on too long. But the point is that we've got a fundamental structure of which the public should be very, very skeptical to begin with before they start with their skepticism of evaluating the candidates.
Alan Ward, I mean, we're talking about money buying an election. The money definitely bought the election in Oklahoma's two Republican primary. This is a guy who self-funded almost $300,000 of his own money, but this is also a guy who took and is still under investigation by the FEC for taking corporate contributions, which is in his FEC filings. This is a guy who still has several issues outstanding on him, and this is something that the media normally looks at as, well, that's not really important. Is that important to the electorate?
Well, you know, it's one of the messy problems with democracies is that a lot of uninformed, often ignorant people get a vote along with everybody else. And it can be very frustrating what the outcome is, but messy and as that is, and however much we might not like the results, it's really, really, really hard to come up with some kind of alternative that works better. And it's not just in America. You know, we had this Arab Spring all over Northern Africa and the Middle East, and various countries threw out these dictators, and they're starting to have elections. And lo and behold, some of these people getting elected are people who have who America has a worse relationship with than the dictators who are left out. Democracies create surprises, and we may be very, very frustrated, but whenever you try to figure out a way to have public financing or some other kind of mechanism for controlling how the system works, you create unintended consequences. So I'm not defending the current system, saying it's perfect, but it is really hard to figure out a good, logical way to reform it in a way that you're going to feel better about the outcome.
Bob Hines.
It really is a difficult process trying to figure out what the best way to be to improve our awareness. And I would suggest that it probably would be best dealt with in schools. It seems to me that if we had a requirement in school systems across the country that in high schools, maybe the first year in high school may be a good place to go, and have a, you know, let's talk about how Americans' government is structured and what the obligations of citizens are. Now, it might be that something like that would be about the best thing we could do. There's, to me, it's important that people understand what they're doing when they vote. And it'd be very helpful if we spent a little more time trying to educate our young people as they get closer and closer to being able to vote about the responsibility of not just walking in there and putting a check next to a name that you've heard, but actually knowing why you're talking about saying, I want to vote for Mr. Jones or Ms. Brown.
Congressman Al.
I have a little speech that I give to college students, which I say that I think that the basic structure of our government is pretty well handled in K through 12, particularly in high school. The three branches of government, you introduce a bill in the hopper, it goes to committee, that whole
schoolhouse rock thing.
I think that's pretty well done. And then by the time you get to college, you're into comparative governments and you're into foreign governments and you're into other things. And there's a little gap. And it just annoys me because I think it's about a one-week course. Could be done in high school, could be done in college. And that is, what is democracy? What does that mean? And what does it mean in terms of the vote? I always start that by saying, if you picked the 100 finest minds that have ever lived in the history of mankind and you were able to resurrect them and bring them back and form them into a committee, it would take them about a half an hour to do something stupid. The reason is that democracy is when 51% of the people vote one way, it doesn't mean 51% of the people all agree. Somebody may have voted for it and said, I held my nose and voted for it. They thought it was just a little bit better than it was bad. and other peoples are huge champions.
You're talking about elected officials who voted.
I'm talking about elected officials, congressmen, city councils,
yeah.
what have you. And it comes out yes or no. But it's not yes or no. It's yes, maybe, yes, but, yes, and no, maybe, no, but, you know, all of these various individual things. It's much more complicated. And all our democracy does is turn it into arithmetic. You count the votes, and you add them up, and you say that one wins, and then you make all kinds of extrapolations over what that election meant. Well, it rarely means that at all. And so that you need, for example, if you're going to criticize your congressman because the Congress did something, it would behoove you to find out how your congressman voted. And if you don't like that, it would behoove you to find out why he voted that way, because it may have not been as bad as you think.
Carl Toobin.
There's been a lot of talk on the radio over the last week or so about national service. And I think if there's a bill introduced in the Congress for national service for every young person in this country, that I hope it passes. And I think as part of that program, at the beginning, there should be a civics part of that program to explain to people the importance of voting, the importance of government, and have that as a part of
that. And that our system reflects human nature. Our system is the most human system I know, and it has all the faults and all the strengths of the human culture, and it's not going to be perfect.
You know, but when we look at all the stuff we're talking about, it still goes back to individual responsibility. For the individual to be educated enough to make that decision, not based on a soundbite, but based on true capability, true worth. I mean, I'll tell you right now, if I'm a Republican in Oklahoma too, I'd be a little bit scared as the guy who's running for Congress that wants to represent me doesn't even know the schematics of the biggest political issue facing Congress right now. That troubles me. Have we gotten to a time where complacency runs rampant and that there is no individual responsibility in the way that we elect our officials?
I think we've always been there.
And I think some people are just single issue. They have this one issue that they want addressed, and they're not going to look at the overall picture of the other candidates and what they would offer.
If you want to know the strength of the NRA, and they always talk about all the money they spend on campaigns and all their huge lobbying efforts. You know what makes the NRA so powerful? It's membership.
Right.
It's membership who will vote on that issue and nothing else. And they are so involved emotionally in the issue that they can even get violent in sometimes.
And what about the issue with the same-sex marriage? I mean, that always brings out a
I use the NRA because I think that the critics of it have hit the wrong thing.
Yeah.
They really got it right. They've got a grassroots thing that does it.
Sure.
But there are all kinds of issues like that where you really don't hold the right people speak to the fire.
Bob Hines, you had a comment?
Well, you know, Al and I have talked about this issue a lot in just, you know, private conversation, just sitting around talking.
That's the reason he fell asleep while I was talking.
Well, I knew I had heard it all.
Yes.
And I might say that it's right.
Yeah.
Yes. But, you know, the reality is that we have to find ways to get younger people more aware, and you're not going to educate people who are 60 years old, 55. They know what they're going to do, 60 years old. But the younger generation can be taught that don't just be told it's your obligation to go vote. You know, it's more than that. It's your opportunity to affect national and local policy, and learn a little bit about it. Learn a little bit about the issues. Understand what's going on. And I understand that that's a difficult thing, but one way or another, unless we help unless we find a way to educate our younger people coming out of school and going into the workplace, unless we start getting them more actively aware of what the costs are of certain projects, what the issues are, we're not going to get any better. We're going to be just like we are today.
And we haven't even talked about the media.
Social media would be the perfect avenue for this.
But the social media insists on telling you everything that's wrong.
And the social media also gives it to you in 140 characters or less.
Yes.
Which is basically an electronic soundbite.
Fundamentally working.
Is there anything that we can do, whether it's here inside the Beltway or at the academic level or at the local level, that would convince Americans to take more personal responsibility in who they're voting for, the qualifications of somebody that they're voting for, as opposed to, hey, that guy looks cool and he's got a cool ad? Alan Moore.
This is a hard slog and we're losing ground. I mean, you look at the number of people who registered to vote in the first place, and then the turnout in these races. I don't know what the turnout was in your race, which was a pretty active
dismal turnout.
And a fair amount of money being spent locally by one wealthy guy, dismal turnout. So decisions are being made by these minorities, these subsets of people. But, you know, I come back to what I said earlier. It's very hard to see a clear path.
You don't mean racial minority. No.
Minority of the elected human beings.
Exactly. Thank you. It's a minority of the people who are eligible to vote in given jurisdictions.
And they're hot for an issue.
So the challenge is, okay, we know that only maybe 30% of the people who could vote are going to actually vote. So how do we get our guys out there? A single issue has a lot of resonance because you've got to get somebody willing to go to the polls, stand in line, identify themselves, and vote. And it might take 20 minutes. And a lot of people say, my vote won't matter, and I'm not going to bother.
Ralph. Yeah.
There's an interesting article that just came out in the Hawaii newspaper. Fewer people in Hawaii bother to vote than in almost any other place. And interestingly enough, the highest voter turnout occurred in June 59 and November 1960, around the time that Hawaii first became a state. And the driving force was the first time people were going to be able to elect their members of Congress and to be able to vote for president. Since then, turnout has been gradually decreasing among the electorate in Hawaii.
Let me pat ourselves on the back. It's always an undignified thing to do.
You got a minute to do it.
If there were more programs on the media, and on the media that a lot of people watch, and we're not kidding ourselves, we have a small audience, but on one of the major cable channels or networks, where people would sit down and make their partisanship known and their ability to discuss issues in a friendly and civil fashion, sometimes agreeing, sometimes saying things that aren't okayed by their party and what have you, I think you would begin to restore some faith in the American voter that this is not all a cynical game, that it's a game that is based on how humans work, and that you can be civil and disagree and run the country.
And I'm going to let that be the last word. Thank you very much for chiming in on that. Thank you. See, the soapbox wasn't that bad, was it, Bob? That's what I'm saying. So, anyways, now it's my favorite part of the show. It's the first Tell Me a Story Since I've Been Back. This is the part where whose phone is that? Good Lord, kill that phone. So, anyway, this is my favorite part of the show where we talk about any sort of buzz, any sort of rumor, any sort of scoop that we have. But we got to do it in 30 seconds or less. Al, tell me a story.
I'll do it very fast. We've got two candidates, neither one of which can win.
Wow. Alan Moore, top that.
All right. At the end of the Clinton presidency, he made a very controversial move to pardon a big-time billionaire tax evader named Mark Rich, who it was so controversial that Rich, once pardoned, could never come back to the States. His wife, Denise, refused to testify before the Congress about what she knew about how this got done. She took the Fifth Amendment. Well, this is the family that keeps on giving, because it's come out this week that just last November, she renounced her U.S. citizenship. Now, she's a major Democratic fundraiser who's raised millions and millions of dollars. She's renouncing her citizenship and putting her $65 million penthouse condominium on sale. Why? She says to be closer to her kids who live in Europe, but acknowledges that it will be a huge tax savings
to go to Europe.
This to renounce her citizenship, live most of the time in London. Not what the Democrats needed right at this point in
right.
time. The gift that keeps on
keeps
giving.
Keeps on giving. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
As I said earlier, there are a number of states where Mr. Romney is significantly behind Mr. Obama, and these are states like Ohio and Florida. Speaking from my heart, I can only hope that Mr. Romney does a little better, because if he does not win those two states, he does not win the election, period.
Good
There's
point.
No discussion.
Good point. Call to him and tell me a story.
This is going over to England.
Louder, please.
This was going over to England. There was a woman in the House of Commons who was having a terrific battle with Winston Churchill. And at one point, she looked at him and said, "If you were my husband, I would poison you." And he said, "If I were your husband, I would drink the poison."
That actually was the Duchess. It was a royal family member.
Yeah.
Said that too. That's a great story. Tell me a story, Ralph.
Okay. We've got the politics of the Olympics and Mitt Romney's conundrum. Does he unveil his vice president before, during, or after the Olympics? Romney is going to be going to the Olympics either the first or second week in August. Look for some major announcements to come out of around that time.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
We're still holding Bob. Right now, we're seeing everybody's talking about Portman being the VP nomination.
Yeah.
Bob, that may be the one handicap that we actually worked on, so nice job. We got 90 seconds left. First of all, appreciate everybody's patience with me being gone. It was tough, but we're back. We're back at full strength.
What is your name?
Oh, stop. Somebody smash that phone, please.
It belongs to somebody here.
It does. It belongs to somebody who owns that black jacket. Call the phone. Jeez. On behalf of... You're laughing. I'm serious.
You know, you better stay away. This is not working.
Oh, my God. You guys have got a phone.
Tell another story if you want.
No.
Say goodnight, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie. This has been Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom. Stay with us. We'll be live again next Tuesday. Same time, same station. And we're going to be looking forward to having a full entourage from now on. So that's a good thing. On behalf of Congressman Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Carl Tubin, and Ralph Winnie, I'm your moderator, Russell, Justin Russell, radio's own Justin Russell. We'll be back next Tuesday. Oh, good night, Gracie.